Hey, welcome to Rhymes Against Humanity with Adam Brodsky, number 9. Last week we spoke with Tom Hampton. Tom is a good old friend of mine and one of the gentlest and kindest voices you will ever hear. He's downright mellifluous, is what he is. You can listen to him for hours, and it just makes you feel sweet and homey, and then you just want to go out to a Waffle House and talk some more. So we talked for a good deal. It was actually the day that the DC Navy Yard shootings, and both of us had sort of braced for the ideological batshit that was about to break out on the Twitters and the Facebooks, and it didn't really seem to emerge as we both had predicted it would, unpredictably, and I guess, you know, it means that we may have become numb to all of this, which could end up being sort of a drag. If that's the kind of country we've become, I do think these shootings are still statistical anomalies and not something that gun control would actually cure. But the numbness is unfortunate. But the numbness is in the future and in the past. The one thing we talked about, lots of stuff. The one thing we did not talk about with Tom is that yesterday, or maybe the day before, he posted an absolutely amazing Instagram photo of himself holding Willie Nelson's guitar, Trigger, and I mean, that's the brass ring right there. I mean, other than in country music, other than maybe Emmylou Harris, I can't think of anything more awesome that you could possibly hold. So Tom is one of my heroes for just that reason. All right, here's, without further ado, Tom Hampton, Rhymes Against Humanity. With Adam Brodsky, I am thrilled and honored, and lots of other superlative and kind words, to be here with Tom. Now we just strum C for a while because I can't talk and do two things at the same time. So gotcha. I am honored to be here with Tom Hampton, who I would describe as a serious cat, man. Like I have known Tom for about 150 years. And in the past few, like reading his Facebook posts is one of the great joys of my day, because he's always talking about like hanging with famous people. So we're going to get into all that and everything. But right now we're going to finish up this dumb theme song. Excellent. My privilege. So, I am so happy that you graced me with your presence here in the studio. Most importantly, because I'm so happy that you found some time, man. And it seems like your time in your own bed is precious these days. So I appreciate you sparing an hour or two for me.
Absolutely, man. You know I love you. I've loved you for years, and I will continue to love you for as long as you let me.
So let's. Here, I was on your website today, which found hilarious.
Oh no!
Yes,
it's hilarious for all the wrong reasons, though. It's hilarious because it's like circa 1998.
But I like, here's the favorite part is I went to you got all your little sections, including at the end, like you tagged it on at the end, singer songwriter, which is how I met you, is
way
Tom Hampton,
at the end, yeah.
Singer songwriter. Mm-hmm. And when you go to the singer songwriter, allow me to quote from what it says when you click that link. It says, "This page intentionally left blank." Then the parenthetical. "Besides, it'd just be the same old buy my record at iTunes, blah, blah, get it at CD Baby, blah, 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 stuff that you hear all the time. Not that I'm discouraging you, but this site has a different focus, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, down the road, this may change somewhat, but for now, this is it. Sorry, colon, in parentheses, smiley face." Now the thing is that when I met you, I can't remember the first time we actually met. I'm assuming it was at the Grape Street, right? You think?
I think we actually met before that.
Okay.
Because I think we both used to frequent Phil Stahl's open mics.
There we go.
Way back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, back in the pre-Watergate era. But yeah, we've been floating in the same circles for a long time, man.
Right.
I've always admired your songwriting and always thought you were a really ballsy cat.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. And
it's all true, man. So
I remember, like, now that you mentioned, of course, it probably was Phil Stahl, because I was such a dog then. I would drive, you know, whatever, up to wherever the hell, Schnecksville or wherever he was putting on an open mic. Yeah.
We all did it. And we all went wherever we could to play a song or two for somebody and just, you know, try to hopefully get a gig out of it or, you know, some radio time or something. And, you know, and people still do it all the time, man.
God bless them. We were doing it when gas was $1.20 a gallon. So
right.
It was a different
game.
Right,
there's that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And people had disposable income and not everything ever was available at your fingertips. If you wanted to hear music, you had to go work for it. It wasn't just sitting on your... one of my first lasting memories of you were hosting the Grape Street Open Mic, but almost before I got around to it. You were hosting like in the mid-90s.
Well, Nick Everett hosted it for a long, long time.
Right.
And at one point, the guy who owned it, Tom Hill, had sold it to, oh my God, can I actually not remember their name?
Nice.
Wow.
It's okay.
Sorry.
We're all old, dude.
Dead air slash brain fart. But anyway, there were new people that bought it, and Nick continued to run it for a while, and they approached me and asked me if I would consider hosting it. And, you know, I had a pretty decent little run there. There were actually a couple of runs, you know, interrupted by Ben Arnold and
Matt Sevier. See, when I first came to the Grape Street Open Mic, I believe Matt Sevier was hosting.
Okay.
And he had that the Mary Catherine song was all over the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the equivalent of a rock star.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
it's funny how that works in Philadelphia. We have our own little way of doing that thing. You know, it's like XPN latches onto somebody, you know, like a babe onto a teat, and then they decide that, you know, this is who we're going to champion this month. And so for that month, you can't, you know, they're constantly on the radio, constantly in your face. You know, they're playing Exponential, they're doing everything. And then inexplicably, they fall from the face of the earth.
Pop, yep.
You know, I can count the exceptions to that rule probably on my testicles. You know, one of them being, you know, Amos Lee. And the other one being Jeffrey Gaines.
There's two.
You know, but everybody else, it seems like that when I first started getting involved in the Philadelphia music scene, there was a woman that they were playing incessantly named Iota.
Yeah.
Remember Iota?
With the long red hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
the thick hoagie mouth when she talked. It was a deep Philly accent.
Yeah. And there have been countless others since, you know, but it's, you know, I mean, they did the same thing with Nancy Falco. One minute she was, and then she moved off to Ireland and disappeared. And there have been, you know, literally, you know, you could line them up and probably reach a planet of the solar system. But they tend to do this thing where, you know, this is our flavor of the month and you know, enjoy them now because next week we'll be on to something else.
Well, I'm proud to say I was never chosen flavor of the month.
You know, and that's okay because there have been a lot of people from Philadelphia, if you think about it, who have just completely gone an end around the whole XPN machine and have actually done really well for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, with, you know, no thanks to the hometown at all. But, you know, at that point in time that you're talking about, you know, there was just this endless parade of Philly bands. You know, June Rich was playing every Wednesday night, you know, when I was hosting the open mic.
Right. Oh, yes.
And, you know, Tom Del Coley, God bless him, I still love him with all my heart.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was tending bar on Monday nights, and Tom was booking some of the bands. And, you know, it was a really nice minute there for a minute.
Tommy
you know?
Is the guy that hooked me up with WNOC.
Yeah.
He said, this would be a great match.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so he was the guy that put that together, and that was transformative.
Knew.
Yeah,
he knew.
I love Tom. I bumped into him. Oh, I forget where it might have been. It might have been at the Dylan thing last year. I don't know. I bumped into him somewhere. He's doing. Mm-hmm. He's selling real estate now. That's his gig.
Yeah, Tom actually was trying to help me find a place to live when I had to move a few months ago, and you know, I had talked to him before we moved to Philadelphia to try to find something as well. But Tommy knows the neighborhoods and he knows where to go and he knows where not to go.
Yes.
He was a huge help. Yeah, he was and is still one of the nicest guys I know.
In 97 I got dumped real hard. I, you know, just like a bad breakup in your, like the last bad breakup of my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote 23 songs in 16 weeks. It was that kind of thing, right? I still sing a dozen of those today. But it was, you know, I was ridiculous. I went over to Susan Rossetti and Steph Hayes had a shitty apartment on Christian Street, and I would go over to them and just like cry on the couch.
Man, those were some great days. I remember, you know, this was in the middle of the June Rich thing. They had just done a gig, and you know, I had opened for him this particular Wednesday night, and there was a guy, and I don't know if you
remember. That's right, they were packing the place every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday, man.
To the rafters.
Insane. Yeah. And that was before air conditioning, too. There was no air conditioning in there.
Crazy.
And there was this little guy that used to work in, and I don't know if he wasn't really a door guy, but he was just like the cleanup guy. The guy with the accent, his name was Goti.
Yes, yes, yes.
You remember Goti?
I haven't thought about him in 20 years.
Well, I'm only thinking about him now because we're having this conversation. But Derek Dorsey had an apartment right up the street from the Grape.
Okay.
It was like a little walk up, you know, somewhere off one of the shops on Main Street.
Was he living with Terry Tompkins?
I believe so.
Okay.
And we all went up to listen to tapes of, in fact, I remember specifically now that I'm thinking about this, it was the Wednesday night that Garcia died in 95.
April 95.
Yeah, yeah. And they had done, you know, they played that night, and I was there that night, and we all went up to listen to tapes of a show that they had just done, I think at the TLA or something like that. They had just played the TLA.
Right.
And they had recorded it, and we were going back to listen to it. And we were sitting in Derek's apartment. And Derek was in his typical Derek state for that time of the day, you know, with his eyes looking, you know, very much like Santa Claus's eyes. And Goti was there for some reason, and we're all sitting around listening to music, and Derek is just kind of sitting there basking in the awesomeness of the planet. And Goti gets up and goes over to the sink and starts washing Derek's dishes. It was the strangest thing, and it made everybody in the room incredibly uncomfortable because... You know, it's like we're sitting here having a good time, and this dude has nothing better to do than to get up and go start washing dishes. But yeah, I have so many memories of that era because there was a lot of hype about Philadelphia then, you
right?
know? Because you know there were, you know, bands like those guys. This was like the last gasp of notoriety that we had, you know, after the Robert Hazard Hooters era, you know, in that little gap there in the mid-90s.
Well, Rough House and Interscope were still labels, right?
Rough House and Interscope were happening then, and there was a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ben had gotten signed to Rough House and put his record out through Columbia, and you know, the Caulfields were happening then, and, you know, Huffamoose was happening then. And
right.
There was a lot of stuff going on. At that point in time, it was kind of a weird time to be around.
Yeah,
but the Grape was such a great hang.
So we stumbled into it. I forget whether I used to play at John and Peter's. My first open mic was John and Peter's.
That's a cool room.
It's a very cool room, especially since I'm not too tall.
Yeah, well, you can't be too tall no. in there.
But and then that's where I met Butch. He came into John and Peter's, and I was like the king of that place of the open mic. And then. I guess either the two of us together went down to the Grape or... I don't know. So we ended up at the Grape. And then we would go there pretty much every Monday for a few years. It was a really great scene. And I remember that I was very, very excited because, like Butch and I were whispering, when Ben Arnold walked in, is that him? Is that the rock star? And I've told Ben this story. He's like, really?
Yeah. And at that time, man, and you know, I haven't really... I played with Ben for about the length of an episode of Law & Order a few years ago. You know, we did a couple of gigs together as a sideman. I was playing in his band. Yeah, we went up to the Dawson Street thing a couple of times, and I would go up there for the Sunday night Dawson jam. And, you know, Ben was like, so, you know, do you ever, like, play gigs? Like, well, yeah, sometimes, man. So we went out and we did a couple of things, but he's a lot more approachable now than he was then. Then he was... you know, he was an interesting cat to be around. He was an interesting bunch of fellas, as Mick Jagger used to say about Keith Richards. But, you know, time is definitely done right by Mr.
Oh, yes. I have a tremendous amount of respect. Matter of fact, not him. He'll be in sometime in the next few months. But Boja's coming in Thursday.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. So I got a stellar week.
Boja's been in Japan.
Yeah, he's actually big in Japan. Like
it's like the song. He's big in Japan.
So I'm going to talk to him about all that. But let's talk about you. Let's talk about you. Let's start with the roots. You're from Tennessee.
I am.
Savannah, Tennessee?
Savannah, Tennessee.
Where is that?
It is right on the Tennessee-Alabama line. It's in Hardin County. If you follow the length of the Tennessee River down through the state, it does this little figuresque thing.
Okay.
And I lived in a town that was right on the banks of the Tennessee River on the Tennessee-Alabama state line. If you leave town going south on Highway 69, you'll cross over into Alabama, and the next town that you come to is Florence, which is Muscle Shoals is like a suburb of Florence.
Wow.
So Muscle Shoals was directly over the line, and there was a great radio station in Florence, WQLT, Q107, that used to play all this music that would be recorded in Muscle Shoals, and, you know, like it would be a band that got signed to Capitol to make one record and then vanished. But they were playing this record all the time because it was recorded there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was funny because in my later years when I would roam record stores, I would find these records in dollar bins that I heard all the time as a kid. It's like, oh, wow, they've got the Mistress record, you know, and you know.
So what was your
stuff like that.
What was your first guitar?
Well, I actually didn't play guitar. I played drums when I was a kid. I actually fashioned a set of drums out of like buckets and stuff because, I mean, we grew up dirt poor. I mean, like no cable TV, you know, pooping in a little house behind the house, poor, you know.
It was an all-year folk fest for
it
you.
Yeah, it was exactly that. So I got interested in music when my mother got me an AM/FM clock radio for Christmas in seventh grade. And it was either the best thing she ever did for me or the worst thing she ever did for me. I'll never know which. But I got interested in music then and, you know, kind of started playing these homemade drums along to stuff on the radio and figured out at some point, you know, in my mid to late teens that, you know, while this was cool, that you couldn't really write a song on the drums. And, you know, I got interested in all the typical, like, you know, ultra sensitive, moody singer-songwriter stuff that, you know, a lot of people hate now, you know, Jackson Browne and James Taylor and Dan Fogelberg and all that stuff. And I wanted to play guitar. And I met a guy who ran a leather shop down the street from where I worked. And he had a guitar that he was selling because he had to. He needed like $50 to pay for something. You know, I don't even know what, but I gave him $50 for this little Yamaha classical guitar.
Okay.
And
like with gut strings and everything?
Yeah. And that's what I learned to play on. And that thing, I took that with me when I went into the Navy out of high school. It went to Iceland with me. It went to Wales with me. It went everywhere I went. And when I got out of the Navy, I went back home and I actually hunted this guy down. I couldn't find him anywhere for the longest time. I was home for a week, and it took me like 2.5 days to actually just get a phone number for him from calling people that knew him. And I called him, and you know, he remembered me, and we had a nice little conversation. I said, "So what are you doing? You know, you doing anything this afternoon? I'm gonna go over to Dairy Queen and grab a bite. Why don't you come with me?" And
that is such, I love this story. Keep going. Going
so,
to Dairy Queen.
So he came over and we sat down and, you know, we had a couple of burgers and we're, you know, talking about, you know, he had a leather shop and he did this great leather work, you know, like horse saddles, you know, stuff like
right.
that. And so he was getting ready to leave. So I said, "Well, you know, hold on just a minute. I got something I want to give you." So I went in the trunk of the car and came back in and gave him back the guitar that he had sold to me, you know, like 7 years before that.
Right.
He's like, "Well, you know, I can't really afford it." I'm like, "Dude, I'm not asking you for him. I want you to have it back."
Why?
Because it was his, you know, it was his, and I knew that it pained him to sell it. And,
oh, okay.
You know, and I had gotten my use out of it. I had moved on to another guitar by then anyway, and I wanted him to have it back. So I gave it back to him.
Like sometimes when I read your Facebook posts or just when I'm in the same room as you, I feel like such a shitty human being just compared to you.
Dude, believe me, I am completely capable of being an asshole, and there are people who would line up to tell you that. So, you know, but I have my moments.
Okay.
I like to think I have my moments.
Nice. Okay, so did you now you're a guitar player, you're a strummer. Had you been writing songs in the Navy?
I started writing, and I actually still have a notebook full of stuff that I wrote
wow.
when I was first starting to write. And if I ever really, really find myself in a constipated situation where I need a bowel movement, but I can't make it happen any other way, I reach for that notebook. Yeah, it was the same 300 crappy songs that we all write when starting out.
I got mine,
you know,
too. Yeah.
Rhyming, you know, came with became. You
uh-huh.
know, it's like, oh. did you really do that?
Woody Guthrie gets away with it. Nobody else can do it. Only Woody. What is the oldest song you've written that you would still play that you?
Wow. Probably not that old.
Okay.
I mean, as you know, I don't really play my own stuff that often anymore to begin with. But
I have a feeling if you're talking about finishing up your own new record, you must have just a buttload of new fans from this Marshall Tucker gig.
Well, you know, that's been interesting because my Facebook friends increased by like 1,000. You know, I got all these friend requests from folks that I met at shows, and But, you know, those guys are, you know, typically when you're talking about a band like that, I mean, we don't really play a lot of new music when we go out, you know?
No.
Every show that we do, when we walk on stage, we know what the first song is going to be. You know, the first song is going to be This Old Cowboy.
Okay. Tonight.
And after that, Doug's got a sheet taped to the floor next to him that's a list of songs, and he just calls stuff out, whatever he feels like playing.
Nice.
You know,
that's
so
the way to be.
You really
set
have to be
for,
on
for the week.
Well, you know, I didn't really anticipate that. You know, when I first started playing with him, I thought, you know, and I asked Daryl, the guy that is our stage tech, guitar tech guy. I was like, so, you know, what's, and he's like, ain't no set list. He's like,
now,
okay.
Now, does he play the same, when he plays a song, does he play it in the same key every night?
Yeah.
Okay, because Dylan doesn't do that. And from everything I've read, what Dylan will do is, among other dickish moves, he will play a song. He won't tell you what song he's playing, and he'll start it in whatever, in some random key, you know, and it might stay in the same key the whole song, it might not. But what that gets is, and I've read people talk about, it might have even been on one of your threads, that he gets, musicians have to bring their A game, and it's Bob Dylan, so they do.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, you can't phone it in at Bob's show because you never know what he's going to play. And he's got 5,000 songs.
Right.
You know, 500 that he wrote and 4,500 more he knows.
Uh-huh.
And so you gotta keep your mind sharp. Now, the converse of that is you can't really relax and find that pocket always because you're always sort of tense like you're going to be attacked by a bear.
So either horrible things happen or amazing things happen.
That's jazz.
One of the two. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some of the guys that have played with him, I mean, well, as you know, he hires monster players.
But oh, yeah.
There are other guys floating around out there that have kind of walked in and out of that circle that would never go back for $1 million.
Yeah, if you can't hang, you know.
Well, you either have that sense of adventurousness or you don't, you know.
I also feel that a lot of people wouldn't put up with it if he wasn't Jesus Christ, you know.
Right. Right. So. Well, there's that too. A lot of guys would just say, you know what, I don't need this.
You
know?
Yeah.
And it would be like, you know, thanks a lot, but no thanks. But I went to see him with Michael Tiersen. He and I went to see him when he played with Mark Knopfler.
I was at that show, the Spectre, Wells Fargo. Yeah.
Yeah. And Mark Knopfler was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, just came in with his band. They knew the tunes, they knew the set. And they just, I mean, they were one of the best live bands I've heard in a long time.
That was a great night. I mean, until Dylan took the stage.
And then Dylan came on, and it was decidedly less so. You know, it's great to have that sense of adventurousness and to want to try to extract things out of your players that, you know, that might be a little harder to get to that are under the surface. But you got to give a guy something to go on.
I think he set his band up to fail that night. I don't know if the whole tour was like that. Remember how the stage was set up?
Yeah.
They were all way in the back, way upstage.
Yep.
They couldn't connect with an audience, and the lighting was like in here, just a yellow light.
It was a very strange looking show. It almost looked like the house lights, you know, like the house lights had come up at some point.
Yeah,
and because you know when you look at the stage when it's lit for a show, it looks one way, and when you look at the stage when the house lights comes on, it looks a totally different way. And the stage looked like the stage looks like when the house lights come on.
Yeah, I can't wait till the band comes out.
Like a what? Yeah, exactly. and it was just such a strange night. You know? And like you said, I don't judge the guy. I don't judge him, you know, by that show or by anything that he's done. You know, Bob is kind of the 180 degree, you know, opposite of Neil Young in that aspect, where I judge Neil for everything he's done.
Okay.
You know, Bob is Bob, and I can live with that where Bob's concerned. Neil, not so much.
I think Dylan gets a lot of breaks because, I mean, clearly he's the best songwriter to ever live.
Yeah.
I've been to 12 or 13 Dylan shows. And Bob has been to about 7 of those. And I'm it gets to the point where when he comes around, I'm like, really, do I want to risk $45 to possibly see him not care whether he's there or not?
Ugh. And it's unfortunate because I wonder what's going through his mind. I wonder if he's doing this literally just to keep his overhead paid, or if he's doing this because he feels like he has something to contribute. Because when you wrote The Times They Are Changing, you know, maybe you don't really have that much more to say at this point in time. I don't know. I don't know if he feels like his best days are behind him and he's just trying to create a paycheck, or if he actually feels like he just needs to throw himself into this chaos for something to come out of it.
I guess he loves the touring. I mean, now remember, you know, as nice as you tour with Marshall Tucker, that's his, he wouldn't do that on his worst day. You know, he's touring like,
yeah,
like the guy that invented being a rock star.
Yeah. And he does all these things, like the thing that he did with the baseball parks a while back.
Oh, I saw with Willie Nelson.
And just, you know, going, I'm just going to go play, you know, minor league baseball parks.
Yeah.
Yeah. How cool is that?
That was very cool. You know? I saw that. I saw the show in, they played in Camden Rivershore, but I wasn't around for that. I saw them in Montclair, New Jersey.
Okay.
With, and that night, Dylan did not play the guitar at all. He played nothing but keyboard. Exactly. Yeah, right. And Willie brought it. Willie brought it hard. You know, comes out Whiskey River and then 90 straight minutes of amazing.
Yeah.
And Bob was gravelly and phoning it in and playing the, didn't play the, felt, he's like, fuck it, I'm not playing the guitar tonight. So he didn't.
Well, then you don't, you know. Who's going to say, Bob, no, here, strap this on. You got to show up.
I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Bob Dylan. You owe these people who pay your fucking salary.
You know, I believe that as well. I think that if you're going, especially when you're charging that much money. I mean, if you're talking about an $8 cover on Tuesday night at the Grape, maybe, maybe not.
I don't care. I don't care if it's a free show. If somebody gets off their ass and turns off American Idol to come see you, act like you're grateful. Give them the show that they deserve.
Right.
So, right. I mean.
I'm just talking about on the scale. You know, if you're playing, you know, on a Tuesday night at the Grape, maybe you have a hard time finding your motivation. If you're playing to the Wells Fargo Center, you goddamn well better find it somewhere.
You
know, under a chair, you know, in a little bag on the bus, wherever you've got it.
In a bag on the bus, well put.
You know, because, like you said, I mean, you know, people talk.
So, okay.
People talk. And Bob Dylan, I mean, there's Expecting Rain. There's all these sites where people, you know, congregate, you know. And
I think he gets a break from those, I mean, I'm as big a Bob Dylan fan as anybody, or I was. And I think that people give him breaks that he shouldn't get.
That's probably true, just because of his stature.
Yeah.
You know?
Clearly, greatest songwriter ever. But that doesn't mean that you can constantly abuse your audience for whatever reason, for your own.
And like you said, people think that, well, okay, it's almost like that Grateful Dead mentality. Like, yeah, the show sucked tonight, but tomorrow night it'll be amazing. You know, and the Dead did that too. You know, there would be nights when they just, you know, could not pull it together for whatever reason. But then, you know, 2 days down the road, they'd be phenomenal. And people always knew that if they saw an off show, that the next one they saw, you know.
I actually only saw one Dead show in my life, believe it or not.
You've seen one more than I have.
Okay. I saw 87, Dylan and the Dead, and I went to see Bob.
Okay.
Who stank. That was one of the times. Now, Albert Grossman had died 2 days before, so maybe that's an excuse. I don't care. To me, that's not an excuse. I mean, but nonetheless, the thing I was stunned by in the Dead show was that, first of all, they didn't talk to their audience. They don't talk to the crowd. They just sit there and practice all night.
Yep.
And but I also sort of understand that, like, they're going out, you know, the reason you're doing a 20-minute solo is somewhere in there, especially if you're high as fuck, you might find some magic in there.
Yeah.
And if you're willing to go out and try that, you know, you might fall on your face sometimes, but sometimes you're going to get to that special moment.
Right.
How much improvisation do you do with Marshall Tucker?
More than I expected.
Really?
More than I expected because, you know, we did, I had known those guys for a long time before we ever played together.
How'd you meet them?
Well, I met them at Sellersville. I was playing with Skip Denenberg and Skip was opening up for the band.
Okay.
And we became friends at that show. That was probably 2006 or something like that. It was a long time ago.
Okay.
And, you know, got to know Doug and got to know Chris Hicks, who was playing guitar in the band, you know, at the time, and gradually got to know everybody else, you know, just from literally from bumping into them at shows.
All right.
Whether I was on the bill with whoever the opener was. And I know that, you know, I did two shows with them just at Sellersville, one opening with Skip and one opening with Blake Allen. And, you know, just, you know, and then, you know, we became friends on Facebook and started corresponding there. And you know, whenever they were around, I would, you know, if I wasn't working, I'd try to go to the show. And last November, they were doing two shows. They were playing at the Lavoie Theater in Millville, and then the next night they were playing at the Newton Theater up in Newton, which is way up in the Delaware Water Gap area.
Okay.
And my buddy Mark Schultz, who's known the guys for years, you know, he and I were going to go to the show in Millville, and I got a text from Doug while we were on our way to the show. I basically came home from work and met Mark and we left. And I got a text from Doug saying, are you coming to the show? And I replied, yeah, we're actually on our way. And he asked me if I was bringing my guitar. And I was like, well, no, I'm coming from work. So we got there And yeah, had a short conversation, you know, before they went on. And he's like, "Did you bring anything?" And I was like, "No, I came from work, man. I, you know, just came to see you guys and say hello and watch a show." And so they went out and played, and he came off, and he said, "You know, we're playing up in Newton tomorrow night." And I was like, "Yeah, well, you know what? If you want, I'll bring my rig up to Newton tomorrow night, and we'll, you know, we'll do it tomorrow." So I, you know, threw the stuff in the back of the car and went up and set everything up for sound check. And they do not sound check. They do not sound check. They do, they have their crew do a line check.
Okay.
And they carry their own monitor rig. You know, no matter what they're using, where they are, they always have their own monitor rig.
Okay.
Where they are. So, you know, everything is pretty much always programmed in and dialed in the way that they want it. You know,
do they bring a monitor? They have their own guy running monitors?
They tour with two drivers. There's a bus and a truck. And then there's a front of house guy, a monitor guy who's also the tour manager, and then Daryl, who's the stage tech. So it's kind of a five guy crew.
Okay, so they're bringing their own guy to run front of house.
Front of house,
and the, but the front of house is the house sound.
Yes.
Okay.
So he has to tie into whatever they've got and just make it work. But the monitor rig goes everywhere they do. You know, I forgot what I was even talking about. Oh, yeah, they don't sound check.
Right.
They do line check, so there is no sound check. So when we got to this gig, you know, I set everything up, and you know, Daryl came and put a mic on it, and they dialed it in, and the band got there, their customary, you know, 45 minutes or so before showtime.
Right.
And, you know, we all said hello, and he's like, "We're going to go out, and we're going to do This Old Cowboy, and then right after that, we'll do Fire on the Mountain, and I'll bring you out for that." So I brought the pedal steel, I brought a lap steel, and I brought an electric guitar. And yeah, he said, "You know, we'll do Fire on the Mountain, and then after that, we'll just see what happens." So I came out, and we did Fire on the Mountain, and then we did Take the Highway after that, and I played lap steel on Take the Highway, and I ended up staying out for the whole show. And we were doing a show a week and a half later in Sellersville that I was actually opening for as
right.
a solo. So, you know, he told me to make sure I bring, you know, the rest of my stuff and play with the guys in Sellersville. So we did the same thing. I came out, played the whole set. And the next night they were playing at Infinity Hall in Norfolk, Connecticut. And he said, "You know, if you feel like driving up, if you don't mind making the drive, come up and play New Year's Eve with us." So
have you been, are you getting paid for these so far?
Or? Yeah.
Okay, oh, sweet.
Well, yeah, he went to hand me money at the end of the Newton show, and I put my hand up. I was like, "You don't, you know," and he's like, "Nope, ain't nobody does nothing for free for me."
Sweet.
"I don't ask anybody to do anything for nothing."
Yeah.
So, you know, he paid me for that one, paid me for Sellersville, paid me for every show I did. And, you know, we went up to Connecticut, and I pull up in front of the place, and on the marquee it says, you know, Marshall Tucker Band with special guests Danny Korchmar and Jeff Pivar. And that kind of blew my mind because, you know, Danny Korchmar has played on a third of every record that was ever pressed.
Right.
You know, and Jeff Pivar has played with, you know, he's played with, you know, Crosby and Nash. He's played with Mark Cohn. He's played with all these people. You know, so when I go in and I'm wheeling my amp down the aisle to set it up, you know, they're playing Shaky Town, the song that Korchmar wrote that was on Running on Empty.
Okay.
And they came, you know, they did their sound check. I set my stuff up and we all went downstairs and had dinner together. And I said, you know, I'm sitting there across the table from Danny Korchmar. I was like, "Dude, I'm going to try really, really hard not to make this into like a guitar player interview thing, but I have so many questions." And he was just the nicest. I mean, he looks a little like he'd just as soon punch you in the gut as talk to you because he's kind of got that New York thing.
Right.
Just the way he carries himself. But he couldn't have been nicer, you know, and he said something to me that night that I've kind of known for a long time, but that, you know, it was nice to have somebody like him say. You know, we were just, I forget who we were talking about specifically, but we were just talking about why some guys get hired and some guys don't.
Okay.
I think I had made some kind of self-deprecating remark about my abilities or something, and he's like, "Dude, I'm far from the," he's like, "I can think of 100 guys in New York City that could, you know, basically, you know, wipe their ass with me."
Right.
And we got into the conversation about, you know, why guys get gigs and guys don't. And he said, "I'll tell you something right now, man. If you walk in the room and they're not glad to see you, you're not going to stick around for long." You know? And it's true. I mean, because, I mean, just in Philadelphia, I can think of 4 guys that are pedal steel players that could just, you know, rip me a new asshole. And they're working. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, life is no different in this realm than it is in any other realm. You know, whether you're a musician or an accountant or a lawyer or, you know, a forklift driver or whatever you might happen to do, you know, it just always seems to boil down to, you know, can you get along with other people?
Hmm.
You know, can you find a way to get along with other people? Because, I mean, nothing else really explains Lehman Brothers or AIG. You know, those dudes rose up to the levels and those companies high enough that they could completely screw the entire American economy, not on merit, but because they could get along with other people.
You think? Because I sort of picture those alpha dudes as just like, they didn't care if they hurt feelings. You look at billionaires love firing people. That's how you get to be a billionaire.
Yeah, I think that's true, but they also know who to fire and who to kiss up to.
Oh, okay.
You know, but I don't even know how I got off on that tangent to begin with.
You're the Dalai Lama of Havertown. There is much wisdom within you.
Havertown. I miss Havertown.
So where are you living now?
We live in Morton, which is down in that little corner where the Blue Route meets I-95.
Oh, sweet.
You know, if you leave the airport and get on 420 and just keep driving, you'll run right into
it. Is that Chester County?
No, it's still Delaware County.
All right.
You know, it's not far from Chester County, but it's close. But
and yeah. We're close to tax-free shopping. You got to buy big stuff to go to Delaware. That's where I buy my TVs and such.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah. And all my wine, of course. Go right over to Total Wine. So but, you made this conscious effort of instead of trying to get seven people to come see you sing your own songs, you're like, screw it, I'm going to sit in the back and play pedal steel.
Well, I made a record in 97 with Steve Wellner, who's to this day one of my best friends. Steve, well, you know what, I won't say it because I don't want Steve to be mad at me. Steve kind of fell backwards into a really great gig in LA, and you know, he's
a music gig or a straight gig?
A music gig.
Oh, great.
He's working as the personal engineer for a guy who's produced some records that I don't like very much, but you know, he's a legit guy.
I don't know who this is, but obviously if you care, just do a little Googling because now it's a fascinating story.
Yeah. Well, my only real beef with the guy is not his musicality or the way that he makes records. It's that every record he makes has the same snare drum sound on it.
Okay.
You know, whether it's a record he did with Tom Petty or a record that he did with the Traveling Wilburys or a record that he did with the band that he was with in the 70s or a record that he did with Roy Orbison.
Who could this possibly
be? You know,
be?
It doesn't matter which one of those records you listen to. They all have the same...
It's a good sound.
Yeah, it must be. It survived the test of time, man. But yeah, you know, he works for him. He's his personal engineer.
Wow.
And... It's funny because I found this out because I was flipping through Palladia on cable, and there was this documentary that they had done about, you know, he had just re-recorded all these songs from back in the day.
Okay.
And they were walking through this, you know, documentary, and I hear this voice, and Steve has a pretty unmistakable voice. When you hear him talking, you definitely know it's him, man. And I heard, and I was like, and then they actually showed a clip of him sitting behind the console on camera, and I probably still have a mark from where I slapped my head. I was like, oh my God, that's, you know, it was one of those moments. But you know, I made this record with Steve.
Was this the Angels record?
The Mutual Angels record, yeah.
And that's a reference to your kids?
It was actually a reference to a D.H. Lawrence quote that Rob Bresny had printed in Real Astrology in the city paper. How cheesy is that?
That is worse than a reference to your kids.
That's
that is
worse. It's much worse.
How are we friends? Did that? That's crazy.
I used to read it on a regular basis because this girl that I was dating at the time was yeah, into astrology, and I just always thought that Bresny was a complete maniac.
Okay. Because
the stuff that he writes, it's like you read it and it's like, so what kind of a week are you saying I'm having exactly? Because I don't understand a thing you just said. But he wrote this thing where he talked about, I'm paraphrasing, but it said the author D.H. Lawrence had a theory that, you know, in life, you know, in heaven, you know, that each of us were split apart from our soulmate, and that, you know, somewhere on earth, you know, was walking the person that would be our actual, you know, match. And he said, yeah, this will be the week that you will walk out into the world and encounter your mutual angel. And that's where I stole it from.
Okay.
So And it was a reference to my kids, and it was a reference, you know, it wasn't just words that I thought sounded good together, because the songs on that record are from, you know, the era and time when, you know, my first marriage was breaking up and when this relationship was starting to form. So, you know, there's all these songs on there that kind of, you know, trip from one end of that period into the other. And, you know, it just seemed like a good title for the record.
Okay.
But I put the record out, and of course crickets ensued, you know.
I've been there.
As happens so often. And, you know, I had surrounded myself with these people, you know, Steve being one of them. You know, Steve still loves that record to this day. You know, he and I just basically hunkered down in that little room in Manayunk and made that record together. We were a team, and we were going to go out and conquer the world. And we were going to make this record, and we were going to, you know, run it as far up the flagpole as we could run it.
Okay. What were you using in 97? We recording to tape?
ADATs.
Oh, ADATs, right.
ADATs. The old blackface 16-bit ADATs, as a matter of fact. And, you know, we had great people come in to play on it. You know, Ronnie Crawford, it was the last session that Ronnie did before he left to join Lisa Loeb's band.
Okay.
The infamous Saturday Night Live gig. We were cutting that record during the blizzard of 96.
Oh,
we
yeah.
Me and Ronnie and Steve and Gary Lee were snowed into that room for a day and a half, drinking Mountain Dew and eating vegan hot dogs. And, you know, it was one of the best experiences I've ever had working on a record, whether it was mine or somebody
else. You still play
else.
Songs from that record if you ever play solo?
On occasion, yeah. Because, I mean, I, you know, like I said, when that record was done and it didn't do as well as we thought it would, yeah, it screwed me up a little bit. You know, I got to the point where it felt like a regular job, you know, trying to go, you know, not so much the musical part of it, but the part of it where you have to be your own champion 24 hours a day.
Oh.
You have to be, you know, trying to find ways to get people to gigs, which has not gotten any easier. You have to, you know, you have to worry about whether, you know, Dan DeLuca or somebody is going to write anything nice about you in the paper, or, you know, if A.D. Amorosi is going to rip you a new one, or you know, all those things that you had to worry about. And I still remember the breaking point. I had been working with this manager who booked me for two dates in Kentucky. One was in Louisville at a place. I can't remember what the name of the place in Louisville was, but the second night was at a place in Elizabethtown. And I did this gig. And he had some kind of a hookup set up where he was going to have me stay with somebody. And they were supposed to come to the show and announce themselves and the whole nine yards. And this is in the third week of February, 1999, I believe it was.
Was it the Rudyard Kipling in Louisville?
It wasn't the Kip. It was another place. I cannot remember what it was. It was some, like, Words That Sound Cute Together coffee house. I can't remember what it was.
I'm sure I played there.
But so I did this gig in Louisville, and then, you know, nobody showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever shows up, because why would they? They don't know who I am.
Yeah, some putts from out of town, right?
And didn't have a place to stay, so I ended up sleeping in the van.
Oh, yeah.
And the first night it was okay. You know, I went to McDonald's the next day, washed up, changed clothes. You know the trip.
Oh, I do.
And just kind of, you know, hung around Louisville, went to the Guitar Emporium and, you know, did some, you know, like window shopping on Bardstown Road, and then went out to Elizabethtown for this next gig. And did that gig, and again, didn't have a place to sleep. And the heat in the van was kind of iffy. So I drove up the road. I drove up 65 far enough to get the inside of the van nice and warm, had the heat on full blast.
And that's right, you crank it for the last 15 minutes because you're about to pull in.
You're about to pull in. You know what you got to do. So I had the heat cranked until, you know, I felt sweat running down the back of my,
yeah,
you know, and pulled over, and I had a sleeping bag in the back of the van. And I crawled into the sleeping bag and went to sleep. And when I woke up in the morning, it was so cold that, I mean, all that was sticking out was my face.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't feel my face when I woke up and it was time to drive. And I got up. I still had my clothes on because it was cold as balls, and had to scrape the inside of the windshield before I left, because,
yes,
you know, my breath and the condensation from me sleeping inside the van. I had to actually scrape the inside
I know all about
of
it.
The windows. And I had to, I actually found a service station on the way home that I could plead ignorance and write a check for gas so that I'd get, I'd have enough gas to get home.
Right.
I had made no money. Oh. I had come home with nothing, and you know, I had to write a check and, you know, somewhere in northern Kentucky, you know, and hope that it didn't get back to the bank before my paycheck went in the next week. And that was pretty much it. I got home and I came inside and I took my socks off that I'd been wearing for 2 days. And sat down and just kind of stared out the window for I don't know how long. And that weekend, I think, broke me, you know. And as a result of my association with Steve and having made the record, you know, I was getting calls every now and again to do, you know, like dobro on this session or mandolin on that session. And I played on the June Rich record, and I played on a Polar Creep album that my buddy Bruce had done. I played
Polar
on
Creep. I haven't thought about them. Oh, what was the name of that dude? T-shirt.
Bruce Reinfeld.
Bruce Reinfeld, yes.
Yeah. So I started doing some session work and stuff like that and liked it, but, I mean, there just isn't a lot of it. And I was still living in Reading at the time, and I started playing in a cover band and just basically kind of immersed myself in isolation of playing, you know, Allman Brothers songs and stinky, you know, bars with pool tables for about 2 years, you know, and just
before the smoking bands.
Hunkered down and did that for and got my chops together, because I didn't really do a lot of that. I didn't play any lead guitar. I just, you know, kind of played, you know, whatever stuff fell into my lap. But,
right.
You know, certainly not to that level, but it got me to a point where I was playing. I was a little more confident about my playing anyway. And then I started playing with Charlie Degenhart from Phoenixville.
Right.
Played in Charlie's band for a while and graduated from Charlie's band into another band, and then, you know, just kind of worked my way, you know, kind of back into, you know, playing with singer-songwriters and people who, you know, I was always like the utility guy. Like, there was always another, you know, dick-swinging lead guitar player in the band, and I always kind of became the utility guy by default, because,
right,
you know, I play all this other stuff that nobody else wants to carry around. So, you know, I did that with Charlie. I did that with a couple other guys, and then I started working with, you know, Dan May and J.D. Malone and some of those cats. And, you know, Dan is really the only guy that I work with where I'm, you know, kind of predominantly focused on guitar. Everybody else I play with, I'm the utility guy. You know, John Lilly referred to me as his utility bitch.
Nice. You know? Well, I'm looking on your list here, and, you know, because you got on your, all the instruments you play, not just electric sitar, but choral electric sitar.
Right.
What is a choral electric?
Choral was, they were built by the Dan Electro Company.
Oh, so that's a brand?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not just an electric sitar through a pedal.
Yeah, it's like Coke or Pepsi or Jell-O.
Oh, okay.
It's one of those things where, you know, they put a specific kind of bridge on it to create that effect. And I don't even know why I felt the need to put that in there, but I did.
Well,
but it's
because when I make my next record, we're going to find a place to put choral electric sitar.
It will be perfect for your record.
Yes.
I used it for... we did a track on Michael Tierson's record. We did a cover of Solitary Man, and we used that for the solo at the end of the song.
I can see that.
So it's, you know, it's kind of a nice little, it's a nod to those records from like the 60s and early 70s that have that, you know, you hear that on like Hooked on a Feeling by BJ Thomas. That's the sound in there. The little single note intro that you hear on You Make Me Feel Brand New, that's that.
Okay, right.
You know, it's something that you hear in places, but you don't really attribute it to, I know what makes that sound.
All right.
You
know, my podcast, I have made two crucial errors already. One is, we've been talking for 47 minutes, and we haven't had you play a goddamn song.
I'm okay with that.
I know, but people want to hear. There's actually people that listen to this, and you're very good, so the point is the songs. Otherwise, it's just two fat fucks talking.
How did that even happen?
Because I'm awesome at this. but the other fuck up is I forgot the whiz before we started. So we're making a little quick stop, and then you're gonna sing a song. All right, so we are back. One of us has a newly emptied bladder, so I'm feeling great already. So, like I said, it is time for Tom Hampton to play us a song. Whatever you want, dude.
Okay, man. Well, this is a song that was written by a couple of friends of mine, Curtis Wright and Craig Lee Fuller, who were both with Pure Prairie League at the time that I heard this. It's a song that they wrote and put on a record that they did back in the middle part of last decade, and I kind of got the itch to make a record of some sort about a year and a half ago when Tiersten and I made the record that I made with him. It was all covers, and it was all songs that, you know, Michael had picked, you know, specifically to address the kind of mood that he wanted to create with this record. And, you know Michael, and I know Michael wouldn't be upset if I gave any of this away, but, you know, Michael's wife passed away in 1995, I believe it was, and,
yeah.
And he's never gotten over it, and we'll never get over it. You know, it's something that haunts him to this day. And a lot of the songs on that record that I did with him, you know, kind of informed all that. And after we did that record, you know, he kind of planted the seed in my head that, you know, I could do something similar if I, you know, didn't feel like writing. And I don't really write that much anymore.
How many songs do you think you've written total?
That are of any worth? Probably less than 100.
Okay.
You know.
It's an impressive number. It's a legitimate number.
But, so I got the notion that, yeah, because we had this conversation and he said, well, you know, you've probably played with enough different people that you could just do songs that they wrote and make a record out of that.
Nice.
And I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. So I came up with this notion that I would do a record like a double CD of, you know, one disc full of songs written by people that I'd played with and the other disc full of songs written by people that were, you know, that were inspirations to me in whatever fashion.
Is it called Me and You?
No, it's that actually would work though. It's called Friends and Heroes. It's about 80% done at this point. I've actually gotten a lot of people that whose songs I covered to actually guest on it.
Oh, that's the way to be, yeah.
This song, I had done a couple of gigs with Craig Lee Fuller, you know, just kind of solo acoustic things with me accompanying him.
Now, pardon my ignorance, are either of these two dudes the ones that wrote Amy?
Craig Lee Fuller wrote Amy.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And Curtis was actually in the band when I first got to know those guys. And Craig was also in Little Feat for a while during their little resurgence during the end of the 80s when they came back. He was singing all Lowell's parts. But this is a song that those two guys wrote for the record that they did, and I think it was... Yeah, that's in tune.
What kind of dobro you got going on there?
It's basically an economy Regal dobro that I bought on eBay. But Paul Beard, who's one of the probably the best builders in the country, has a shop in Hagerstown, Maryland. So when John Lilly and I were playing together, I had bought two of these that were identical, and John had one that was a different brand, and we both took the day and drove down to Paul's shop. And Paul completely, you know, gutted it out and put a new resonator, put a pickup in it and all that stuff. So it's got the guts of a Beard dobro, but it's in a body that if it gets crushed by TSA, you know, I'm not going to end up laying on the floor in the fetal position, sucking my thumb and weeping gently to myself.
You ever played a national, an all-steel one?
Yeah, I have one of those as well.
Okay. Do you prefer the wood? Is it warmer or...
The wood's a little warmer. It treats the mid-range differently. The Nationals don't have much bottom end. You know, they're kind of all mid-range.
They look so fucking awesome, though.
Oh, they're great guitars, and they sound awesome for certain stuff. There's a track on Lily Yell's new record that I played that guitar on, and it's a blues machine.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this is a little more... I mean, it's got a little more body in the bottom end, and it just... You know, the wood sounds different than the metal does, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're all cool instruments. And then this thing over here... that I may or may not get to play is an old Hawaiian guitar. And it's actually hollow.
Is that a Wiesenborn?
Yeah.
I just read it up here. Act like I'm a gearhead. All right, so what are you going to play us?
I'm going to play a song that... I'm going to play a song that Craig and Curtis wrote called The Cost of Doing Business, provided this thing stays in tune long enough. Sick and tired of all you have to do, just keep pace these days. The hoops you have to jump through, it'll make you crazy. drag you down as you were to keep your good name in this town. It's time to say your goodbyes to the innocence of youth and open up your heart to the cold hard truth. That's just the cost of doing business. Forget that stuff about a rags to riches. It's never black or white. It's only shades of gray. Better believe nobody needs you. Get ready to bite the hand that feeds you. Choking all those words you swore you'd never say. Well, that's just the cost of doing business these days. You say you're sick. That's a wrong verse. You can't recall a time when right and wrong were so easily defined. No one was leading you on. It's sad to see how the rules have changed, where you've got to lose yourself if you want to play the game. That's just the cost of doing business. Forget that stuff about a rags to riches. It's never black or white. It's only shades of gray. You better believe nobody needs you. Get ready to bite the hand that feeds you. Choking all those words you swore you'd never say. That's just the cost of doing business these days. Sometimes it gets hard to gauge the cost of living. What you give equal to what you're giving. Well, that's just the cost of doing business. Forget that stuff about a rags to riches. It's never black or white. It's only shades of gray. You better believe nobody needs you. Ready to bite the hand that feeds you. Choking all those words you swore you'd never say. That's just the cost of doing business. The cost of doing business. The cost of doing business these days.
Nice. And that's going to be on the Friends and Heroes?
Yes.
And those guys join you on it?
Craig is talking about singing a harmony on it. Sweet. Curtis left the band a while back, and I'm having a hard time tracking him down. But I've got Jim Fotoglow, who played bass in Dan Fogelberg's band for a lot of years, is also a recording artist. He's put a few records out, and he's got a song on there called A Job Well Done, which he's singing harmonies on. Craig Bickhart, who I've played with quite a bit
Craig.
A number of years. I've got one of his songs on there that's never been on one of his records.
Oh, sweet.
That's on there. Had a couple of musicians who contributed tracks that have helped out with Jackson Brown's drummer, Fritz, who's been a buddy of mine for a couple of years, played drums on a couple of songs on the record. You know, just different people like
that. Now, you're no longer having it. Are you... Are you bringing these guys into your house? You just sending them stuff and then are they sending it back?
Fritz, I just sent him the tracks and he sat down and played drums to them and sent them back.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a great way to make records.
I did that for the first time. I'm an organic guy. You know, we're recording this with my one $70 microphone. And Butch sent me the other day. He's like, he texts me. He's like, can you, first of all, he's like, do you have an E-flat harmonica? And I'm like, I'm going to let you answer that yourself, tough guy. He's like, okay. You have a D harmonica? I'm like, yeah, I have a D harmonica. He's like, well, I'll mix it down and then I'll bring it back up when I need it. Uh-huh. So he needed me to do a harp solo and he sent me an MP3. I dumped it into GarageBand. You know, I know this is nothing special for you, but like for me, I'm like, technology.
Dude, it's fascinating. I mean, can you imagine 20 years ago just, you know, sending stuff to people and having them send the tracks back?
Crazy. Crazy,
you know,
but I prefer guys in a room, you know, fuck ups and all.
Yeah.
So I laid down, you know, he needed me to do one little 8-bar solo or whatever. So mm-hmm. I gave him, I put the MP3 10 in a row. I gave him 10 of them. I'm like, here you go, find something you like.
Yeah, it's a fun way to do things, and I've done that for other people. They'll send me stuff, and I'll record stuff and send it back to them.
Yeah.
I had a very nice little workspace in Havertown when we lived there. The place that we're in now. I've actually started refer to the neighborhood as the Shire because the house looks like it was built to Hobbit specs. When you walk in the bathroom, you automatically feel like 8.5 feet tall. It's just like, wow.
Are you owning or renting?
We're renting.
Okay.
Yeah, we're probably going to move again at some point.
Of course. Why would you stay in one place? You're like MASH.
You know, we loved the house in Havertown. We loved it there. We loved our neighbors. We loved everything about it. You know, and essentially the circumstances were, you know, we moved from Reading into that house when I started working in Center City.
Right.
And the lady who lived there just passed away. Her family didn't want to sell it, but they didn't want it to sit there. So they rented it to us through a property management agency that was in Havertown. Well, while I was in California with Boris Garcia, I got a snapshot of a letter that my wife had
received. Forgot you were on the road with them. Okay.
Yeah. She got a letter from the property management company stating that the people who owned the property intended to occupy the unit. So essentially the lady's son decided that he was moving back here because it was too expensive to live where he was, and he could do that, so because I mean it does after all belong to them.
Yeah, it's his place.
So we had to leave. We found this place after looking for a month and a half. We finally found this place in Morton. And it's a nice house. It's a nice house. They're great neighbors. It's just not big enough.
Right.
Know? It's not big enough for...
How many kids? What's going on with you now? How old are they?
23, 21, and 4.
Ah, I love that, Matt. I love that.
Oh, man.
And go through the names.
Every time I say that out loud, I went with Tiersen again to see Jackson Browne in Scranton, I think, last winter. And... I'd been kind of stalking Jackson because a guy that I know out in Santa Monica worked on his guitars for years, and he had a Rickenbacker lap steel that he tried to sell to him. So
okay.
I figured if he wants to sell it to him, he might entertain the thought of selling it to me.
All right.
So I finally got to, you know, I'd mentioned something to him about it a year before, but I finally actually got some time to myself with him, and I said, so listen, you know, that lap steel that Dave Riley used to have, you know, do you still... You know, because I'd said something to him about it before, you know.
Now, is it an amazing guitar or you just want it because it's got Jackson Browne's
I have two of them. Okay. And they're the best sounding lap steels I have by far.
Oh, okay.
I've got a National that's pretty awesome too, but these two Ricks are just phenomenal instruments. And they've got this growl that, you know, the other ones just don't seem to have. But the fact that Jackson owned it wasn't a discouragement to
gotcha.
Me at all. And, you know, I mentioned it, and he just kind of looked down at the floor, and he's like, you know, I had that thing out the other day, and there's, like, these blue crayon marks on the pick guard that my son put on there when he was this tall, and he's 31 now, and I just don't know if I can bring myself to give it up. And I said, you know what, man, you don't even have to say another word, because I've got, you know, decals on the back of a couple of my Martin acoustics that my kids put on when they were about the same age, 6 or 7 years old. And they're 23 and 21 now. And then I mentioned that I've also got, you know, I've got a new 4-year-old. And he kind of raised his eyebrow. He said, oh, wow, man. So you re-upped. And so every time I roll those numbers off, 23, 21, and 4, I hear that in my head. Oh, wow, man, you re-upped. But it's interesting because Danny happened, you know, right as my two older kids were kind of going out into the world and getting their own places. And
you were all, you were this close, my man.
Dude, you know, they, I was that close to being an empty nester for a minute.
Free!
But, you know, having him and having him in the house, you know, as a baby, as they were kind of going out into the world, it's an interesting perspective to look at fatherhood from when you've been through it and you've gone through the whole gamut and you've experienced all these things that, where they're concerned, you can never get it back.
If I had it to do over again, well, guess what?
You do have it to do over again, but as you're singing to your baby, you know, while he's falling asleep, you're remembering that, you know, I've got two other kids who are old enough to drink now, and you know, that moment's gone for them. I mean, I enjoy them in an entirely different way now.
Yeah.
Because we're friends now. You know, my son in particular is this ridiculous stand-up comedian at this point.
Is this Dylan?
He doesn't realize it, but he's one of the funniest guys I know.
You keep talking about him. Yeah, I want to meet this kid.
Well, yeah, like the other day I posted on Facebook, you know, from my son, you know, things I never want to say aloud again. Sir, did you just lick that peach? He works in the produce department at a supermarket. Sir, did you just lick that peach? But he's, yeah, I actually have a note, I have a note on my iPhone filled with things that he said to me that I didn't want to forget. Like I was in my dining room one night, just like we are now, working on demos with a microphone in front of me and the laptop, and with one light on, just like this, and he comes downstairs at some ridiculous hour in the morning and flips the lights on while I'm sitting there with my guitar on my lap, you know, with my headphones on. And he looks at me and he starts laughing, and I took the headphones off and I was like, what's the matter, man? And he looks at me and he says, you look like Kenny Rogers about to sing Chocolate Rain right there. One other time, Wendy and I are sitting on the sofa. We've got grapes in a bowl between us on the sofa. He comes downstairs, does his normal routine, comes downstairs, starts walking toward the kitchen. I said, dude, you want some grapes? He's like, no thanks. I only like artificial flavors. One other time he says to me, and I don't remember for what reason, he says, if I had only a day left to live, I'd want to spend it in Iowa, because that way it'd take forever for it to be over.
Nice. That's
so
beautiful.
A few years ago, I'm in Peoria doing, they had built a memorial. They were having a ceremony to dedicate a memorial in Riverfront Park to Dan Fogelberg, and they invited me out to play this thing. So as
is
it
he from Peoria?
Out, he's from Peoria.
Didn't know that, okay.
Yeah. It turns out that the Iowa border is only 45 minutes from Peoria. So I set my clock and I get up an hour and a half early the next day and I drive to the Iowa border, pull over, and take a picture, take a selfie with my phone with the Welcome to Iowa sign over my shoulder. And I put it up on his Facebook page and said, I don't know if today's the last day I have to live or not, but it'll take forever to be over because I'm driving home today. He comments on it and says, what are you doing there? I hope you brought board games because all they have in Iowa is corn and incest. Yeah, it's stuff like this all the time with him. The last one that I put on, we were at a restaurant having dinner, and Danny, he was holding Danny in his lap, and Danny was coloring on the little, you know, the drop leaflet that they give you to keep your kids occupied. And Danny is coloring and humming, you know, humming some song, and it's some kind of scary, you know, Transformers-ish kind of, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he's coloring, and Dylan leans over and says, good boys don't have evil theme songs, Danny. But it's just, you know, there's a whole list of them. I could do a whole another podcast of them. But well, he's just hilarious. You know, I'm very proud of all three of them.
Excellent. You
know, Danny is great, and Jada is phenomenally talented. She sang on the J.D. Malone record that we did 2 years ago.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, she's got a great ear for harmony, an awesome voice. You know, she's got a band of her own.
The thing though, one of the things that I marvel at about you is that you seem to have it all. You're like that woman that can have it all. Because as a musician, you get to choose whether you want a family that loves you or you want a musical career. Like being able to get away with both, especially one with kids, both older and younger kids, like that is tough because to be a musician, it's not a lot of fun to be a musician's wife.
No, it's not. And it's funny. You could probably talk to her for an hour and get a whole nother perspective on this. But, you know, believe me, whatever it might look like from the outside, I can assure you that it's certainly much more turbulent on the inside, you know. And she would tell you that.
But you're doing it, man. Like, look at, you know your peers. Like, a relatively few of them are existing like that with a marriage and kids and everything that ends up somewhat stable.
Well, you know, but then again, you know, I can still see, you know, my daughter when she was young, you know, standing with her hands against the storm door, watching me drive away. It may look idyllic, but it's not.
No, I'm not saying it's idyllic. I'm saying the fact that you're accomplishing it is amazing. Is bully for you, sir.
Well, and other people there again would tell you that, you know, your definition of accomplishing might need some boning up.
But, fair enough.
Yeah, you know, the fact of the matter is, and anybody who's tried to do it, you know, and I know whether, I mean, Craig Bickhart is a phenomenal husband and father. He's a great guy. But Craig spent most of his formative years writing songs. You know, Craig was able to hunker down in Nashville and write songs and be at home before that whole industry kind of collapsed. I mean, Craig wrote four number one songs. You know, he had four top 10 songs, had, you know, a number one. You know, his songs have probably been covered by 200 different people. You know, everybody.
Give me a couple of his big hits and who covered who.
He wrote, This Old House is one of them. That song's been covered by probably 30 or 40 people. He wrote a song for Kathy Mattea. Kathy Mattea had a number two with You're the Power.
Okay.
Pam Tillis had a number two with In Between Dances. There was a number one that he wrote for a guy named Ty Herndon called It Must Be Love that he co-wrote with Jack Sundrud.
Man, he has a completely different perspective of going to get the mail than I do.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that's because country music isn't as friendly to, you know, oldies as it used to be.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, there are people who have written songs that were on the charts 3 years ago that have seen their, you know, it does dry up.
I met at Kerrville, I met the girl, I totally forget her name, but I met the girl that wrote, Oh, What a Feeling, Toyota. And I was like, how is that? She's like, I put kids through college with that. Uh-huh.
Well, my buddy Joe Sarasano in North Jersey was a singer. He sang... you know, I like the Sprite and You. He sang the one Navy commercial. He did a bunch of them and did the same thing. He put his kids through school. You know.
You ever have a track of yours on TV or in a movie or anything?
Nothing like that. The closest thing I've come is there was a track that I did with Skip Denenberg that was in the soundtrack for Invincible.
Okay, right.
The Vince Papale movie.
Right.
I can't think of anything else. You know,
Skip's the reason I got to open for Kris Kristofferson, sort of.
Skip's an awesome guy.
Well, they forgot to call him and ask him for the gigs. He went to Boston for his day job. And like when it came like 3 hours before the show, they realized, I thought you were going to call Skip. It's his gig. And they asked me, I just went around to move chairs around to see the show. Uh-huh. Kris Kristofferson at the TLA. I was living in 5th and South at that point. And they asked me sort of joking, I forget who was running who was manager of that place at the time, but he was a friend of mine.
Was it McNally? Mike McNally?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Yeah. And he says, you want to open for Kris Kristofferson? And he thought, you know, because he thinks of me as a punk rocker, right? He thought I would say no. I was like, yes, most definitely yes.
Uh-huh.
And I went home and got my guitar, and I avoided eye contact with everyone for the next 3 hours for fear that they would take this gig away from me.
That's awesome.
And I called up like an ex-girlfriend and had her come down and sell merch. I had just put out Folk Remedy. And so Chris had nothing to sell. He was just, I felt like playing a show, you know, so he got in his big old bus and drove here and played a show. And so I was the only guy selling stuff. I pretty much almost paid for my record that night because people had nothing else to buy.
Wow.
And I met, and I'll tell you this story, like I've told it to everybody. I played, you know, and he probably didn't hear much of my set, came in at the end. He was out in his bus, you know.
Uh-huh.
So he comes in at the end. And at the end of the night, he plays his deal, I play my deal, and I walk up to him. I just want to thank you, you know, thanks for letting me open. Even he, you know, he had no idea. And he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, you're the guy that opened up for us. You sang the girl I like. It's a Diesel Dyke. The chick I dig digs chicks. That takes me back." The next day, it was in my bio. And then I went to shake hands, and he hugged me, and our little heart racks clinked. And, and it was like, there we go. That's one of my most amazing rock and roll moments, which will segue us into who's the biggest dude you ever met? One of your totally, you met Willie Nelson. What do you got?
Well, probably the dude that I personally think should be on Mount Rushmore is David Lindley. You know, I love that guy as a player. I mean, he's not like a famous dude.
Right.
But,
He's not unfamous.
As far as meeting heroes, yeah, most of them have been musician guys. Most of them haven't. I mean, I've met Jackson and I've met, you know, different people like that.
Okay.
But most of the guys that I met that I really felt like I clicked with were guys that do what I do, you know. Guys like Korchmar and David Lindley and Rusty Young from Poco.
That's awesome. You're like the brotherhood of the backline.
It really kind of is.
That's, you know, awesome.
And they've all been wonderful people.
I was cruising through your Facebook posts this afternoon, boning up.
Uh-huh.
And you know, you got not only fans, but also some... I saw that you posted when Michael McDonald accepted your friend request. That's pretty cool.
I don't think that's even him. I just... It made me laugh, and I thought, I've got to put this up.
But there are people, whether they're Marshall Tucker fans or other musicians that are you know, talking about how good you are and how much they miss you when you're not at shows. That's got to feel good.
It's a little hard to take. I have people. There's a couple of people who constantly are posting about, you know, you should be a full-time member and this, that, and the other thing, and it's kind of bewildering to me.
Do they have other guys that play pedal when you're not around?
There's one guy in North Carolina who they bring up every now and again. I know that he did a couple of Grand Ole Opry dates with him a while back.
Have you played the Opry?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, but I'm told my day is coming.
Oh, man.
So that'll be one off the bucket list.
Yeah, no kidding.
But, you know, Buddy Miller, you know, another guy
that
who's just, you know, down to earth, you know, loves to talk about, you know, gear, loves to talk about...
Wait, so he Buddy Miller plays with Marshall Tucker?
No, Buddy, I bumped into Buddy and Jim Lauderdale were in town back in February, and I got to hang with him. Well, the first time I met him was actually in Nashville. I was there during Americana Week, which is actually starting this week. And Buddy walked in with Greg Leese, who's another phenomenal pedal steel player. And they both walked in and sat down at the bar, and they ordered. And I timed it just as a lady was bringing their drinks. I just stuck a $20 bill in between the two of them and handed it to her. And he looked around, and he's like, "Oh, man, you don't have to do that." I was like, "I know I don't have to, but as much as I've stolen from you over the years, I figured the least I can do is buy you a drink."
You're a smooth, you know, motherfucker.
So, and we had a great conversation, and he remembered me when I saw him in Philly last winter. And,
nice.
You know, and it's funny because the rest of the guys from JD's band, we were there with JD's band, and they were all just kind of sitting at a table, you know, drinking beer, and I was walking around the room. I like to talk to people, you know. I was, Mickey Raphael from Willie's band was
playing
with Sammy Lanas that night. You know, he was on the same bill we were, and you know, I told Mickey, you know, we've got a mutual buddy in Skip Denenberg and had a nice chat with him.
Oh, I didn't realize Mickey and Skip were friends, but that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, well, Skip and Willie go back a ways, too. And
I did know that. Okay.
Spears, who played bass in Willie's band for many, many years, who passed away a couple of years ago, was a good friend of Skip's. And actually, there's a song that Skip wrote with B called How Can It Already Be September, I think it is, that I'm cutting for this record as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's how Skip was supposed to have the Christofferson gig, because he was friends with Willie and all that. Yeah, and John Flynn was there at the show, and you know, John Flynn was backstage and everything, and I could tell John Flynn was like, "Why aren't I opening?" You know, because he's talking about how he and Willie Nelson trade Christmas cards every year, and I'm like, "I just stepped into it, man. It was awesome. It won't happen again, but
come early and arrange chairs next time."
That's the key.
Yeah,
that was an amazing, amazing night. So that was a lot of fun.
And a lot of times, it's every bit that it's there's that much serendipity involved when things happen.
Yeah,
you know, it's, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier. It's not always, you know, the guy that plays the best that gets the gig. You know, and certainly that's been true of me of every gig I've ever gotten. Because
but you bring a lot to the table now you because you can play every instrument. You also play tasty. You're never overpowering. From what I gather from this hearing you play, you're never trying to upstage an act. You're always where you should be in the pocket.
That always works the other way around. Anytime you come in and decide that you're going to blow everybody away, you always end up looking like the douchebag.
Right.
You know. The best thing, and there's a guy, I can't remember his name now, but this guy wrote Danny Barnes, is his website, is olddannybarnes.net.
Is that the Bad Livers guy?
He's a banjo player.
Okay.
He wrote a post years ago called How to Play in Somebody Else's Band. And I mean, there wasn't really any news flashes in there, but anybody who wants to do what I do should read that, print it out, read it every night for a year.
Okay.
Because it's, I mean, job number one is make your boss look good. Whatever you do, make sure that it's in the interest of making your boss look good, because if you're making him look good, you're also making you look good. And you'll get an opportunity to show your stuff, but make sure that you save that for those opportunities. You know, you have to have a reverence for the song to do this. If you don't, it's not going to work.
Okay.
You know, you have to play what's appropriate for the song, and you have to make the song better, make the vocalist better, make whoever's, you know, because that's what your job is. You know, it's not to be, you know, the hotshot lead player. It's to make the song sound better, and I try to do that whoever I'm playing with.
See, now I mean, that obviously makes perfect sense, but that is not the mentality of a guy who's writing his own songs and fronting. Like, did you have to make a conscious switch, or is that just a part of your nature to understand?
I think it grew out of the fact that I was a singer-songwriter at one time and wanted people that played on my stuff to approach it the way that I approach it. And, you know, I mean, everything in life is an education, but I think that the time that I spent doing that certainly informed what I do now, because you really have to know how to pick your spots. You have to know when it's appropriate to play something and when it's not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it.
Play us something you wrote.
Something I wrote. Dude, I don't know if I can do that.
Oh, shut up. Do it.
I'm serious. I don't know if I'm... I may have to borrow your
guitar. I have a regular guitar, dude. Here, play a guitar.
Okay. I love that.
Yep.
Something I wrote. Outside tonight, the stars could fall into line here, where the darkness meets the light. We could watch the traffic thin, watch the signals start to blink. I could say that I love you now. You could act like you don't know. Find a new place to begin. Maybe you could even smile just once. Maybe no one has to know. Maybe we could try again. Oh, we could try again. We've put so many miles behind us, running down this destiny. Just to find a brand new distance that's crept in between you and me. I could say that I love you now. You'd act like you don't know. Maybe you could even smile just once. Maybe no one has to know. Maybe we could try again. Oh, we could try again.
That's intimidating, playing sideman for the sideman, by the way. That's nice. What's that called? Try again?
That's Brand New Distance. That's from the Mutual Angels record.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
I actually wrote a couple of things working on a record about a year and a half ago that are kind of languishing right now that I'm probably going to try to do another record of original songs after I get this particular project wrapped up.
Okay.
It's it should have been done a year ago, frankly. But you know, between trying to get guest artists worked out and stuff like that, and then in between, you know, I lived in Havertown when I left to go to California with Marshall Tucker, and when I got back, I lived in Morton. You know? And there are still boxes that I have. This was back in June going into July, and there are boxes that I still haven't unpacked from the move.
Now,
so
the
busy so much.
The Marshall Tucker gigs. Are you? You're not schlepping your own gear anymore. You show up on stage with tuned guitars waiting for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sweet, sir. Yeah. That's the dream,
dude. You know. Yeah, I really don't even know what else to say. I mean, you know, that run that we did in California was the first extended one that we've done. You know, I did the New Year's Eve thing with them, and then we did like a real short run. Up here in the Northeast in March, and then we've done like one-offs here and there, like Rochester, New York, and then we did Taste of Syracuse, and we did basically anything that's in the Northeast that's within my reach is pretty much an automatic. And then when they do these longer runs, and there were a couple of instances when Chris Hicks, one of the guitar players, has a solo band, and he wanted to take some time off to do his own thing, and they had me come along on a run to Texas and Louisiana and Arkansas, and there have been a bunch of things scattered around.
So on the bus, you get your own little berth?
I actually have Stuart's old bunk. Stuart passed away a few years ago. Stuart was playing guitar with the band for a long time.
Okay.
And he passed away. The guy that replaced him is this guy from Spartanburg named Rick Willis, who is the embodiment of the bastard son of Dickie Betts and Toy Caldwell. He's a phenomenal player.
Nice.
That's the thing. And since this isn't, network radio, we can talk like this.
Yeah. But
anytime you get into a situation, where you're dealing with a bunch of new people, whether it's a new job or whether you've gotten married and you're trying to figure out your wife's family or a band, there's always that 1 or 2 week period where, whether you're aware of it or not, and normally you're not, but it's happening in your head, whether you're aware of it or not, the game they call find the asshole, because there's always one. If it's a new job, there's always going to be one guy who's going to piss you off. There's always going to be one guy who's going to, who's going to do whatever, who's just going to rub you the wrong way. Whether it's something they do consciously or not, there's always going to be somebody whose personality you're going to clash with. And, I still haven't figured out who that is with these guys.
Oh, wow.
Everybody who's part of this group needs to be there. It's not the same. When Chris was gone for those few dates, it was not the same without Chris. If any one of those other guys was gone for whatever reason, it would leave a hole. Everybody who's there is just absolutely the person who should be there. BB the drummer is about this tall and weighs about 90 pounds and eats like a horse, and he's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. Pat Elwood, the bass player, talks like this. He sounds like a Muppet character.
Dr. D.
He's got just a real deep... But he's got a heart of gold. He's a wonderful dude. Marcus, the flute and sax guy, he's from Atlanta. He's a good old boy. He plays his ass off.
Just flute and sax?
Flute, sax, and keys.
Oh, keys, okay.
And, Chris and Rick are... they're my brothers. And Doug has taken me in and treated me like family when he had no motivation or reason to do so other than he just...
Well, you bring the chops. Don't sell yourself short. You're pretty good at what you do.
But everybody in the band, everybody in the crew, Jimmy, the bus driver, the guy that drives the bus, pretends to hate my guts. I get on the bus, I'm like, give me a hug, Jimmy. He's like, I'll knock the hell out of you. We were going from Texas to Arkansas, and Chris and Jimmy and I were the only people that were still awake. Everybody else had gone to sleep. And Chris is sitting shotgun. Jimmy's driving, and I'm sitting right behind him watching TV. Some stupid show about how aliens had actually managed to communicate with Albert Einstein or something like that. And Jimmy says, "Oh, man, I would love to have a fried bologna sandwich about right now, So Chris takes this as a call to arms. Chris jumps up, goes back, starts looking for the toaster. The toaster, okay? He's pulling out the drawers under the sofa and looking everywhere, and he finally finds the toaster. And then he opens the door to the fridge, and it looks like, you know, you're just like seeing, you know, like packs of lunch meat flying. And Chris finally says, "Jimmy, I can't find no bologna in here." Jimmy says, "There ain't no damn bologna." Chris is like, "I thought you said you wanted a fried bologna sandwich." I do, but there ain't no damn bologna. So Chris is back here digging around for everything, and Jimmy just like sent him on this snipe hunt for bologna, and he couldn't find any. You know, you get off the bus, and I see you later. Jimmy's like, "Not if I see you first." But he's, again, he's just the nicest dude, you know, would do anything for you. And, you know, I can't really put my finger on it. They've just all treated me, you know, like a brother since day one. Somebody was nice enough to point out to me recently when I said the same thing to them, that, like, you know, I waited all this time and I still don't know who the asshole is. So he leans over and says, "Maybe it's you." Okay, I'm never going to forget that you said that to me, but thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
That's awesome, dude. So that's great that you felt that you've fallen into such an awesome situation.
They're just, well, I mean, most of the bands that are still doing this that have been around that long, I mean, they've been an entity for 41 years.
Right.
They made their first record in 1973, and they've been around for a little bit before that. Yet most of the bands that are still working are like that. You know, the guys in Poco are phenomenal guys.
Yeah,
you
work through, I'm not in a band, but I got friends from that I went to junior high with.
Uh-huh.
And we had all of our ebbs and flows, and now we're just such old friends. Like, you know, we've been through all that. We got time to fight with these idiots. Like,
exactly.
Half our lives are over.
Exactly. I mean, Poco and America did a show at the American Music Theater in Lancaster, and the two guys from America sat in the lobby and signed autographs until almost 1 a.m.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
The line was ridiculous. I mean, they sat there and signed until everybody was
there.
That's
their job.
They talked to people until everybody was there. You know, they're kind of the antithesis of what we were talking about with Dylan earlier.
Right.
These people respect the fact that if those people don't come to shows, they don't have a job.
They got to get a job, right? They got to go to work like the rest of us.
And, the ones that are still doing this, and it's funny because I remember that from the first time that I encountered these guys at that show in Sellersville with Skip. You know, people were coming backstage and bringing them, you know, cookies and stuff. And you know, is Glenda still in college? They knew everybody. You know, everybody that came back, you know, they knew them. They knew them by name. You know, they knew what was going on in their lives. And that's been my experience with people too. You know, the same people show up quite a bit, and they're all great people. People at some point, and I really first noticed this with the Poco folks, at some point people don't even come for the show anymore. They come because they know that, you know, Jim and Ellen and you know, Dan and Susie, and it's like a little family.
Part of the family, yeah. Everybody.
It's kind of
a
microcosm of the Grateful Dead thing. They come because they know that they're going to see people they know, and they know they're going to get to hear the band.
And any set of band's core group of fans is like that. It becomes a family. It's just that, you know, these family are all sweet Southern folks who are all old now.
Well, and it's that way for some of these other bands too. You know, they all know one another, and they all, you know, it's become a family.
Yeah.
You know? There was a couple that came to, we did a run through New England in, I want to say it was June. I don't remember when it was specifically, but one of the dates on this run was in Hartford. We were doing one of the Kid Rock shows. So it was Kid Rock, Uncle Cracker, and us.
Oh, wow.
And
so did you meet those guys?
Well, I met Uncle Cracker briefly. Kid Rock doesn't want to, I mean, we weren't even allowed to be in the hallway when he came from his dressing room to go on stage. Yeah. But, you know, we did this thing. And there were, you know, 14,000 people there. Hugest show. I mean, I'll never play another show with that many people in front of me. You know, and after the show, we went back to the hotel, and this guy, his day job is that he makes replicas of the Batmobile. He's got a company called Bat Rods Replicas. And he came out, and he brought this apple pie moonshine that he had made. And he put it in, like, these Ocean Spray cranberry juice cocktail bottles.
Yeah.
So there was a bottle on the bus.
And it's clear?
No, it looks like apple juice.
Oh, okay.
It's got apple and cinnamon and stuff in it, and you have no idea what is about to happen to you when you're drinking this stuff. So it's on the bus, and I'm drinking some of this on the way to the gig, and I was like, man, this is awesome. I love this. And we leave the gig to come back, and he's there with us at the gig, and he's like, well, I've got another whole container in the back of the truck. So we go back, and we're tailgating at our own, you know, after our own gig in the parking lot of the hotel. And it's me and him and this guy Mark Schultz that I was telling you about and a couple other folks. And Pat, the bass player, was out there with a friend of his that had been there that he had known for ages. And we're all standing around and they're, you know, filling up cups with ice and passing this apple pie moonshine around. And we stood out there until 1 o'clock in the morning just hanging out and drinking and talking and enjoying each other's company. And it's people like that. I mean, those kind of people, you know, there's somebody like that in just about every town we play.
Yeah. That was the good part about being on the road was getting to see old friends and fans a few times a year. Sleeping in the freezing cold in February and scraping ice off the inside was not. Well, let's wrap it up. Believe it or not, we've been talking for an hour and a half.
Wow.
So
you're going to have to edit the shit out.
Nah, I'll just leave it whole, dude. I mean, it was mostly good.
Yeah, the next day, after the moonshine incident, we all get back on the bus the next morning, and David Warren, our road manager, comes over and picks up the bottle that's on the bus and sits it down on the table in front of me. And I looked at him and I just shook my head. No. And he leans over and he says, "Not as popular as it was last night, I see."
I've been honored to talk with Tom Hampton. You go to tomhampton.com, you can contact him. What I recommend is you become his Facebook friend because he has pearls of wisdom. He is a voice of sanity in the batshit world of the Facebook. And you heard today some knucklehead went apeshit in DC and shot up a bunch of people at the Navy Yard. So it's gonna spark all of the but this podcast is gonna go live in a week. So by then we'll be well into the gun cycle thing again, right. and Rachel Maddow, and the Facebook's gonna go insane. So I rely on you to keep it real, my brother.
I'll do what I can.
But you should be Tom Hampton's friend, and you should be Tom Hampton's front man if you need some work done tastefully in the background. I recommend him as should you. We'll just go out with some chords of Diesel Dyke. It has been my pleasure to be with Tom Hampton. So. Tom Hampton, thank you so much for listening, y'all. I used y'all for you.